San Boniface, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Le Musée de San Boniface, the St. Boniface Museum, the oldest building in Winnipeg that, if you lifted it up and transported it to Quebec, Montreal, and plopped it down, it wouldn't be out of place, I have been told. And I've been told this by Philippe Mayotte, who, Philippe, you're the curator?
I'm the director of the St. Boniface Museum.
You're the director, you're also an historian. And this is a very special museum because this is very much at the heart of the Communauté Franco-Manitobaine, the Franco-Manitoban community. Tell me why this is an important museum.
Well, I think that a lot of people would be surprised coming to Winnipeg and learning that the oldest building still standing in Winnipeg is not a fur trade post. The oldest building still standing is a former convent of the Sœurs Grises de Montréal, the Grey Nuns. The building, in terms of its appearance, again, looks like any sort of the type of building you fully expect to find in the old quarters of Montreal or Le Vieux-Québec, and yet here it is out in the middle of the prairie, so to speak. So to me, the building is almost symbolic of the fact that the French Canada had a very strong presence in the West, dating back, I mean, the building dates back to the 1840s, but the French presence in the West dates back to the 1730s. So again, this to me is almost iconic and very symbolic of that presence.
And symbolic, obviously, of a cultural survival that is unique in terms of the Canadian West. You have a number of very important exhibits here, and the number one exhibit is that of Louis Riel, the father of Manitoba, a very controversial figure in Canadian history. Now, I want to talk to you as an academic at the moment. How do we avoid romanticizing the story of Louis Riel?
I think the best way to avoid romanticizing the story of Louis Riel is actually to go down the library and read the books. There's been more written about Louis than any other figure in Canadian history. If you sort of, I don't want to say limit yourself, but stick with the solid academic books on Louis Riel, things that were written by George Stanley, Doug Sprague, Jack Bumstead, Tom Flanagan. Flanagan, of course, is absolutely hated by many of the people who are fans of Riel, so to speak, but by the same token, he brings a different perspective, and you have to have that in the academic discussion, more or less the fact that Flanagan wrote his book, which basically was considered major revisionism in the 1980s, provoked a bunch of other historians to go out, redo their homework, and essentially, counter Flanagan's arguments and so on. So I think you need to do that. You need to stay away from some other books, which again tends to be romantic, this heroic martyr and so on and so forth. Riel was a politician. Riel, worked hard for the Métis people who didn't have much in the way of education, much in the way of financial or political resources, so to speak. And Riel ran afoul of the rather aggressive Canadian government that was hell-bent on creating a new country from sea to sea. And while the Métis and Riel weren't necessarily opposed to that, they wanted to be made part of the process rather than treated as obstacles. So I think if you get down to the actual reading of the story, rather than what you see in the mini-series or in the little movie or what you might hear from oral historians or oral history, if you actually get down and read the material, he's truly a fascinating character. And the story of Riel and the Métis is a very important part of the Canadian fabric.
And can we discuss briefly the complexity of the legal issues? The story of Riel, or the history of Riel, I prefer to use that term, raises some fundamental historical legal issues which are still debated or could be debated today. Can you just give our listeners a bit of an overview of why this is legal history?
It's legal history. Let's start with 1869. The Hudson's Bay Territory was not part of Canada. It was essentially a British territory administered by the Hudson's Bay Company. encompass virtually all of Western Canada, Northern Ontario, Northern Quebec. The Hudson's Bay Company says it's going to sell its territory to the Dominion government. The Dominion government sends out a governor to be in place on the day of the transfer. So he's supposed to be here when the transfer actually takes place. The Métis, while the territory is still under Hudson's Bay control, essentially say, well, we're not like beasts or a herd of cattle to be sold by the Hudson's Bay Company. They endeavor to create a certain situation where prior to Canadians taking over the territory, there are some kind of negotiations that take place with the people who actually live here, as opposed to a company based in London. So this is the first real resistance. What happens, I guess, from a legal standpoint, is the Canadian government understands there's resistance. They find out that their appointed governor is prevented from entering the territory. They send him a slow note, which basically says, do not under any circumstances claim to take control of the territory, because if you do so and are not in a position to enforce this control, then the local residents are free to form some kind of temporary government because, you know, in order to organize for themselves. So he doesn't get the letter. He announces, McDougall announces that he is now in control of the territory by virtue of the, you know, royal statute, which he isn't, because the Canadian government canceled the transfer. The Hudson's Bay governor, on hearing of McDougall's announcement, basically says, well, it doesn't look like I'm in charge anymore. So you essentially have a large territory with no effective government. The Métis formed a provisional government. They actually have democratic elections within the Red River Settlement to elect delegates to a convention of 40, which creates the provisional government. This provisional government draws up a list of rights, which they send off to Ottawa in the hands of three delegates. These delegates negotiate with the government of Canada for what becomes the creation of the province of Manitoba. That only takes effect on July 15th of 1870, when a legal transfer occurs where the British government transfers authority to Canada. So in terms of who was actually running the Red River Settlement at the time of the negotiations and so on, interesting legal questions. No one ever denied it was British territory. The Rielites never declared any intention of severing their ties with Her Majesty, etc. So that's sort of legal issue number one. Legal issue number two is during the course of the negotiations, it's like any negotiation, whether it's labor unions or what have you. You go into negotiation and you basically say, well, you know, we reach a deal here. By reaching a deal with us, you're recognizing our authority to do so. And, oh, by the way, you know, if we do reach an agreement, you know, management promises not to fire everybody who went on strike. Well, in the case of the Manitoba negotiations, the delegates asked that there be an amnesty issued for all acts that had occurred during the resistance. The Canadian government basically said, well, we don't have the authority to do that. That has to come from Her Majesty the Queen, which means it has to be done by Britain and so on. But we'll make sure that, you know, we'll take whatever steps are necessary to do so. And for his part, Sir George Etienne Cartier, who was essentially the, you know, Deputy Prime Minister, and in the absence of Prime Minister Macdonald, who was in self-imposed exile in Prince Edward Island, Sir George Cartier does write a letter to the British government saying that an amnesty should be issued for everything that occurred in the Red River Settlement. But he basically has his legs cut out up from under him by the Governor General of Canada, who basically says Cartier is just a minister. So that's legal issue number two. Eventually, an amnesty is issued, conditional on exile of 5 years from Canada and permanent loss of civil rights. So Riel is essentially amnestied for the execution of Thomas Scott. So jump ahead 15 years forward. The Canadian government is now clearly in control of the territory of what is now Western Canada, Saskatchewan. Many of the Métis living in Saskatchewan were originally Métis from Manitoba, who lost their lands or gave up their attempts to claim their titles to their lands because of what the Canadian government was doing with regards to the administration of the land promises of the Manitoba Act. Interestingly enough, there was a 4-month court case which just terminated the end of July of 2006 we're still waiting for the decision, but this whole land claims issue is still before the court, so to speak, and will eventually end up before the Supreme Court. So that's another little legal thing that's going on. So Riel is invited back to Canada by the Métis in and around the area of Batoche to organize their petitions and help them get their, you know, confirm the titles to the lots that they are occupying along the banks of the Saskatchewan River and elsewhere. Riel prepares petitions and so on, doesn't get much in the way of answers or cooperation, decides that he's going to repeat what he did in Manitoba and form a provisional government. And, of course, this is where the historians have lots of fun, and I'm not an expert in that particular, in the Saskatchewan rebellions, but one can look at it as Riel essentially created a rebellious situation by forming a provisional government and declaring essentially that since Canada had not lived up to its expectations in the Manitoba Act, that the Métis were free to essentially declare independence from Canada and essentially renegotiate or go on their own route. The other argument is that Riel was organizing the Métis and the federal government was hell-bent on creating sufficient provocation to start a rebellion so they could essentially justify the completion of the Canadian Pacific Railway. Historians are still arguing and fighting about these things today. But needless to say, there was troops sent out, there was an armed resistance, people were killed on both sides. Riel was put on trial for the high crime of treason, and after a rather interesting trial in Regina, he is found guilty and hanged as a traitor on the 16th of November, 1885. Interestingly enough, most of his so-called co-conspirators, those who weren't Aboriginal, were essentially let off with fairly lenient sentences. The Aboriginal participants were all hanged, I think, in a mass execution, which saw, I think, something like 12 of them hanged in one fell swoop. Legalists argue over the merits of the trial of Riel. By rights, for a major crime, he should have been brought to Winnipeg for trial and tried under Manitoba law. Had that been the case, he would have had a jury of 12 instead of a jury of 6. He would have had a bilingual judge, and he would have had a jury made up most likely of 6 Francophones and 6 Anglophones, because that was the process in Manitoba. Sir John A. Macdonald at one point wrote to, I'm not quite sure whether it was the Attorney General or what have you, but says, under no circumstances is Riel to be brought to Winnipeg for trial, because the best we could hope for would be a hung jury. So you have all these sorts of things going on. Afterwards, there's the question of Riel's sanity. Was he too, was he considered too crazy to be hanged? So a panel of 3 learned doctors is appointed, 2 of which are basically right on the federal payroll, and another one is a Francophone. And there again, you'll find correspondence of the Macdonald letting one of the people know that these 2 other guys are going to have to make sure that they outweigh the judgment of this, this French fellow who obviously will support Riel's insanity, and so on. So the whole process, I mean, it gets to the point where it almost becomes irrelevant as to the actual nature of the crime and the legal circumstances, is that the legal deck was so stacked against Louis Riel by the government of the time that I'm convinced it was not a fair trial. And he really did not have the chance to mount a reasonable defense or to defend himself and so on. And again, there's this one book called Justice and Mercy Denied, which really deals into the legal aspects of the trial. So people are still arguing these questions today. Like I say, 125 years after the fact, we still have court cases winding their way through the system, dealing with promises that were made in 1870 with regards to the Métis here in Manitoba.
A last question I want to take it just in a slightly different but related area. The history of Louis Riel is the history of the nation called Canada constitutionally. How does the story of Louis Riel reflect who we are as a nation today?
Well, essentially, if you look at the original Confederation, it was a bunch of white guys sitting around a room drawing up arrangements on how to administer what they would consider the civilized people of British North America. So you had the you know, sort of the politicians of Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Canada at that time, before it was divided back into Ontario and Quebec, sitting in a room. Prince Edward Island was there, and apparently there were delegates from Newfoundland as well. They didn't like the deal. They walked away, and nobody decided to stay.
Didn't come back until 1949.
Well, the Newfoundlanders didn't come back until 49. The Prince Edward Islanders, not until 1873, but nobody thought to send an army in to conquer them or what have you. So the original plan, of course, of Confederation was to eventually, you know, acquire the Hudson's Bay Company territories to create, sort of to unite all of British North America under this banner of the Dominion of Canada. Now, the fly in the ointment was that the civilized people who lived in this vast region known as the Hudson's Bay Company territories, the majority of them happened to be French-speaking, Catholic, mixed-race descendants of French-Canadian fur traders and Aboriginal women.
Called the Métis.
Well, in the eyes of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who came out to explore the West in the 1850s and so on, the Métis were sort of near savages, and they weren't really good farmers, and you know, didn't quite fit what was seen as the future of the West in the eyes of Canada, because the pressure to acquire the West and Hudson Bay territories did not come from French Canada and Maritimes. It came from Southern Ontario, who really saw this as an extension, saw Western Canada as a future extension of Ontario. So the idea that the French would, you know, French Catholic Métis here would basically say, you know, that's okay, we're ready to be part of Canada, but on condition that we have bilingual institutions, separate schools, and so on, all of a sudden, and this was the terminology of the time, that there were going to be the creation of a second Quebec, and that poor little Ontario was going to be sandwiched between these two Quebecs on either side. They didn't like that very much. So even though the negotiations were successful, and a political pressure from Ontario essentially compelled, convinced perhaps MacDonald that the actual issuance of an amnesty for Louis Riel and sort of passing the brush or the sponge over all events was politically not correct. The province of Ontario, for reasons I can't quite comprehend, actually issued a reward, or was prepared to, you know, announced a reward of, I think, $5,000. This is 1870. $5,000 was a lot of money, you know, for the arrest of Riel for the murder of Thomas Scott. So you have all this going on, and so I think constitutionally what's interesting is that the Manitoba Act was eventually endorsed by the British Parliament, which meant that neither Canada or Manitoba could alter the terms of the Act until the 1983 repatriation of the Constitution. So even though in 1890 the province of Manitoba abolished French as an official language, essentially terminated provincial support for parochial schools or for Catholic schools and so on, in 1990, almost 100 years later, the Supreme Court basically looked at the Manitoba Act and said, guess what, fellas, Manitoba is still a bilingual province in the sense that you still have to you know, publish all acts in both languages, you have to provide legal services in both languages and so on. So today, Manitoba, in all but name, is a bilingual province. My driver's license and the driver's license of Joe Smith is a bilingual document, and nobody's dying on the streets and the province isn't bankrupt. So the idea is, politically speaking and constitutionally speaking, Louis Riel in Manitoba did win, and when it comes down to the ultimate decisions of the Manitoba courts and the Supreme Court with regards to the Métis land claims, he may win another stunning victory. So, you know, the book is still not closed because of the constitutional implications of what Louis Riel did.
And because history is a process, not an event.
That's right. It just keeps happening, and this is what I love about this job, is not only do I get to tell the stories of it, but occasionally I actually get to participate in it.
Philippe, thank you very much.
My pleasure.